Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Lab, joined once again by Ben. How are you doing?
Good, thank you, mate. How are you?
I'm good. There's been a lot made of how attacking Postecoglou's system has been and how he's shifted what Tottenham are as a footballing entity. But as much conversation has been had about our defence and how exposed it can be. And I did a podcast for The Lab very recently with a gentleman who wrote a book about Spurs during the 90s. And there was a section of this discussion, a section of his book about Ozzie Ardiles' Tottenham. I'm not sure if you'll remember that Spurs side. It was the one that had five forwards in it. It had Anderson, Klinsmann, yeah. Barmby, Dumitrescu, and Sheringham. And we had two centre-backs, effectively. Full-backs bombed on. Not in the same way that in Postecoglou's system, but they did. They were a part of the attacking system. They'd go into midfield. And it was great. It was brilliant. It was so much fun to watch. But eventually it failed because we could not stop scoring, conceding goals. We were way too open. And we were exposed way too often in the Premier League. The difference is, though, that we had a centre-back pairing of Stuart Nevercott and Sol Campbell, both very young, 21-year-old kids, and a central midfielder who was on his own most of the time. It was different to Postecoglou's system. It's unfair to compare them, but the reality is that in both systems thus far, we do concede big, big chances. Although a lot has been made of the quality of our back line. So these are the sort of things we wanted to discuss, the themes we wanted to discuss on this episode, Ben. Where are you at currently with it all? I still think it's a work in progress, and the defensive stability will become more evident as a part of a system when everything is in place. But at the moment, we are shipping key chances in every single game, big ones.
Yeah, I agree with that. I kind of find the paradox of how highly we rate our defence compared to the kind of general outlook from maybe rival fans or the media that see Spurs kind of shipping goals at Newcastle and Fulham and Brighton and think, well, how can they be that good? How can you put them on this higher pedestal? But it's funny when you look at goals conceded in the Premier League and see that Aston Villa are exactly where we're at, and they're kind of lauded for being a defensively strong side under Emery. And there seems to be kind of more focus and praise on their sort of stability and performances rather than ours. And it's not that kind of yearning for a little bit of a pat on the back and say, and we don't want just people to tell us how good we are. I do think there's kind of a little bit of lazy analysis when it comes to Tottenham's defending. It's funny that you bring up the Ardiles thing. It's like, obviously, that's a little bit before my time. I don't remember it, but it's funny. That's kind of the typical comparison that my stepdad or his group of mates would go to when we have a bad defeat. It's like, becoming a bit like our dealers. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the reference that I've got for it every single time. And you know, thankfully, I wasn't around in those days. But
no, I mean, I would happily relive them again. There's a magical time. Yeah. You know, we'd signed a World Cup winner in Jurgen Klinsmann. We had this this front line that put fear into everybody's into the fear into the hearts of anyone we played. It was so much fun, mate. It was incredible. And we were like, this is a new way to play football. It was the amount of investment that went in that in that that front 11, front three, front five rather, wasn't the same as it was in the defensive aspects of the game. But the principle of all out attack football, which it was similar. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that, because it's like I say I wish I wasn't around, but it's almost like more because you kind of imagine that team in kind of the context of this current football climate and the spotlight that would be on it. And it's like, it's interesting. I want to ask you on that. How much do you think the discourse around playing entertaining football and maybe not getting results has compared to now, where it seems as if everybody is so, you know, there are these conversations around, is it working for Postecoglou? And I know we did a pod on it and sort of talked about that. And obviously our outlook was very much yes, and that it is going to be teething problems at times, and it is a process. But how much do you kind of think that the dial was shifted from the 90s and those times under Ardiles in terms of how under the microscope a team like Tottenham would be? Obviously, we've moved on a hell of a lot from then, but just generally, actually, kind of like,
I think
attacking football versus results, like, how much do you think that's kind of changed?
It has changed massively, because there was a time, and I can only speak for myself because I was a young man at that time, right? I was in my mid-teens. But this feeling carried through until recent times, I think, which Spurs had a way of playing. You know, like, there's this sort of cliched thing, the Tottenham way, the West Ham way. But that was genuinely a thing back in, you know, a couple of decades ago, where your style of play was your identity. And if success came with it, brilliant. And we'd seen much success in the past playing a stylish, forward-thinking, you know, mercurial, but successful at times, style of play. And that was enough. Your identity was enough. But football was very different then. It was... That there wasn't this. There were powerhouse football clubs, but it would shift, and the systems would shift, and the opportunities for teams would shift, so that you could remain true to your identity, and you know that if you keep at something and you get the right manager, that success will come. Everton had an incredible. Were probably the best team in Europe, for example, in the 80s, and would have been given an excellent opportunity to achieve those European successes. Had English teams being allowed to compete in the latter part of the 80s, obviously because of Heysel and what happened over there, and Liverpool fans being involved in incidents that resulted in the deaths of Juventus supporters, meant that English fans weren't allowed to English teams weren't allowed to compete in European competitions. But my point is, there was opportunity for every team, more or less, and that opportunity is less now, and that's because of, I think, the reality is that the more, and this has always been the case, but it was more evident now than ever, is that the more you put the most money in, you pay the most wages, your chances of winning are significantly increased. You look at what Man City are doing. In a long-winded way of answering your question, it has changed.
Yeah,
and style of play is important, but not as important as where you finish in the league. And I think that's like where there are groups of Spurs fans butting heads at the moment. One wanting success regardless of what happens, which we all want, but the other going, well, actually no, what we need is to move back to what Tottenham Hotspur used to be, which is a flair ridden attacking, free flowing football team. And that's what I wanted at the start of the season. I don't know if I've answered your question there, but.
No, it does. Yeah, it does. And I guess as well, like, it's interesting because the money aspect of it then creates that much more intensified pressurized environment, doesn't it? In terms of then the onus becomes much more results, because the people that are pumping this money in want to see the return on their investment. And it's obviously, you bring up City, and obviously how since Pep's come to City, the game has shifted so much more to be about control over the last few years. And City, when Guardiola was first there, and although City leave themselves open at times, and I think that's important to acknowledge in the context of Tottenham, because so do Liverpool and so do Aston Villa. And Arsenal, I think, have found a way to find that balance between attacking intensity but also defensive structure, which is frustrating to look at from a Spurs fan's point of view. But they kind of seem to be the team that sort of mastered it, whereas although City's onus has become on control, I think they have looked that little bit more vulnerable. And obviously,
yeah, I'd agree.
that control comes into when you're talking about the need for results and just sort of how much the football kind of landscape has changed. And I do think Tottenham, like you said, I do think Tottenham suffer from that a little bit, because there have been games where you look at us this season and think we're all over the place here. It's not kind of cutting-edge analysis, but it's just sometimes you feel like you don't understand, or not so that you don't understand what we're trying to do, but you just can't see. There'll be 10, 15-minute periods in games where it's just like, how are we going to get through this? And it felt like that for 90 minutes, really, at Newcastle last weekend. And maybe over the course of kind of Postecoglou's reign, and obviously we've kind of spoken about the fact, or I mean, you've always said about, from the start, it almost felt like, from a Celtic fan's point of view, in terms of addressing us and how we should feel and how excited we should get, is that, you know, there will be a period at the start of the season where things may look a little bit ugly and then he'll figure it out. But we didn't really have that, and the kind of bumps on the road have come throughout the season. But that inconsistency is normal with young players, and especially young players in that defence. The Newcastle game was interesting because maybe you need these games to help you. And so you always learn more from defeat. And I think the Newcastle game can teach Spurs a lot, not just in terms of the mistakes that we made, but how teams will set up against us that then expose our defence even more. I don't think I've seen a team press Tottenham so intelligently this season as Newcastle did. They shut down every single passing lane we potentially had in that first half, forcing Vicario to go long, then leaving Isak as that focal point up front. So when the counter press came in their half, when Son failed to hold the ball up, that then massively put our midfield and defence under the spotlight. Mickey van der Ven makes those two mistakes, but he's trying to cover up for all the work that's kind of failed further up the pitch, so that can happen. You know, the media will put the focus on van der Ven in that game because of the two, you know, almost comedical slips that he unfortunately kind of made. But it was much more about how Newcastle set up to kind of to stop us, and that highlighted our defensive frailties massively.
I guess that's kind of why this conversation is taking place right now, is that we did look very open, and we have been, you know, like you said, Newcastle pressed intelligently, and they probably the most effective press that we've played this season, at that and Fulham's, to be fair. Although we did have chances in the Fulham game that we didn't really have in this. We had a couple of chances that Werner had in the first 10-15 minutes, but kind of, we should have done a lot better, but they weren't easy chances. But it was like when the Tottenham this season go wrong, they go very wrong. And what I mean by that, not that we're getting absolutely battered, or we did against Newcastle, but it's so glaringly obvious that when we make a mistake, that it's on top, that when you expect it to happen and then it does happen, you can understand where the frustrations are coming from. I'm not saying change. I'm not saying that Postecoglou should abandon what's got him to this job and this place right now, because he won't, because that's his tried and tested method. And that, by the way, that's not to say his tactics won't change, but his ethos, his attacking ethos won't change. He doesn't want to be conceding key chances like that. He knows that's no good for the longevity of it, but this might be part of the process to get into where we need to be. And like you say, we might, if you're looking at it stoically and philosophically, that losing to Newcastle might actually be something that helps, as painful as it is in the short term.
But they essentially set the kind of blueprint on how to stop Spurs' inverted fullbacks affecting the game. There was a brilliant thread on Twitter sort of breaking down exactly how they did it. I think it was from TactX_. So go and have a look at that for anyone that's kind of interested. It's kind of really in-depth and insightful. I think what you made a good point there about Ange's, about will Ange sort of change. And there's a big difference between style and philosophy. And sort of how he wants to play, and I think people get the two muddied too often, and I think that Ange's principles won't change over time, but the style in order to execute the best chance of getting results will change. And he's done that over his throughout his kind of career, wherever he's been. But again, I don't think people will, people don't choose to recognize or choose not to recognize that, because he doesn't have the same, he doesn't have the same portfolio as a manager who's maybe done exactly the same things as Ange, but in Europe. And I think that's where the sort of, that's where that lazy sort of trope of, like, you know, the, no, it's not lazy for people to kind of call for a plan B, but and those kind of things, but they are sort of the things that people then revert, like, sort of flip to straight away when we do suffer a kind of defeat like this. And you kind of get into the weeds of what that actually means. What does a plan B mean for Spurs? And I think a lot of it is down to personnel rather than adaption in terms of tactics or anything, because it was clear in that game, and it's been evident in other games recently, and we did a whole podcast about strikers, talking about the fact that we don't have that man that you can rely on as that focal point up the pitch to be able to stop teams being able to counter-press and turn you over, because we don't look after the ball well enough when we get it into those positions, especially Son with his back to goal. That's not really his game. And then that does expose the midfield and defence. So I think a lot of it is down to personnel rather than sort of the tactics. But I think it will be a lesson for Spurs in terms of how teams might look at what Newcastle did and try and replicate that to sort of to almost stop us. But yeah, I think...
Yeah, that's the other thing is it doesn't take much... And it doesn't take much to find a way to get at our system, and yeah. I think there are fans out there that think that perhaps Postecoglou is playing this system because this is his system, this is his only system, this is the only way he can apply a tactic to a team, and that's it, regardless. And it may be, I don't know. I don't know if you can shed any light on this, but studying about how his tactics have changed for his different clubs, but we won't know how that impacts Tottenham until we see it with our own eyes over the next couple of seasons. But what do you think? How, you know, Arsenal, as far as I can tell, don't seem to... I mean, they've scored more goals than Tottenham. They don't seem to be any less attack-minded than Spurs. You've got Manchester City sometimes playing with four centre-backs in his back line. You've got Ben White, who's a centre-back, who's been made as an excellent right-back.
Yeah.
It seems to be, and I know it's not as simple as just putting centre-backs in your back line. Yeah. There's more to it tactically than that. But Arsenal seem so solid and effective going forward. What are they doing that we're not? What's their system? How's their system different to ours, as far as you know?
Well, they. It depends. I think a lot of it hinges on who they play at left back. And obviously, I think Zinchenko has come under fire a lot recently, and there's been a lot of pressure on him from the Arsenal fans because of certain mistakes that he's made. And again, there's always been the narrative around him that he's incredible on the ball, but he kind of does lack defensively, which is maybe why they've shifted to essentially that four centre-back back four that City have adopted at times. And when you look at City, it's that little bit more obvious, because I think when there was this whole huge discussion around John Stones and what is Pep doing, it was almost like people figured it out quite quickly and could see that Stones was popping up into midfield, and people never really saw Stones as that. And Arsenal have kind of followed a little bit further along the way, and City would almost set up in that sort of 3-2-4-1 formation, like a 4-1-4-1 in, if you were looking at it on a tactics board before the game kicks off, Rodri sort of holding down as that single pivot with that sort of mouth-watering four midfield attacking line behind Haaland. But often Stones will step into midfield and play with Rodri, and then Walker will tuck in, and they'll make a back three with Diaz, and Ake, who's playing as that left back, will then tuck into a back three as well. And then Arsenal play in a similar way. Again, it depends on who plays at left back, but Kivior gives them that balance to sort of go to a very solid back four of White, Saliba, Gabriel and Kivior, where you are essentially playing four centre backs. But again, then if you're playing Zinchenko, he will often... it's a bit like a dog in that inverted fullback system. You'll see him picking up the ball on the right hand side of the pitch in the number eight position in midfield. He's kind of got that license alongside Rice to sort of cover that midfield. But now I think they've shifted back to having that actual midfielder in Jorginho to sort of supplement what Rice is doing. And I think Arsenal are sort of starting to come exposed a little bit now, just because of the fact that so many of their players have played so much football compared to the Man City, and I think that's maybe a whole nother podcast in itself in terms of the workload on players, but it maybe is kind of highlighting some vulnerability in their system. I saw a stat that Manchester City have had Manchester City have had zero players that have started over 40 games. Wow. And Arsenal have had seven. And you that's know, all of their key, all of their key men.
It's interesting when I've seen that. Yeah, that all of their players that they rely on in their system, they've played every minute. There's a reason why Saka is limping after every single game, and it's probably because of the amount of minutes. And it's I don't know where I saw it. I think it might have been on TikTok actually. But Smoke Blake was making a really good point, is that you see young players that shine so bright, and they're running to the ground at such a young age that by the time they're 28, 29, they're done. Like Sterling is an ancient footballer for his age. Like he looks absolutely done. And same with Rashford. Even Rashford is getting to a point where he came into that Man United team. He wasn't protected. He became the starlet. He was boosted up. And you see a level of burnout. No footballer can become remain that focused and offer that level of intensity and listen to the same messages from the same manager before something starts to give. I'm not saying that that's happened to Saka yet, but there are signs that it might be happening. And the physical breakdown that he's suffering at the moment seems to be evident.
Now, and I think the point
just quickly, point Ben, on that. Just quickly, just to pick up on what you just said about the Man City and them not losing the players, is that there are times where he's resting players, and you're like, how is he resting him? How is Foden not on the bench? And the reason why is because it's a long season, and there are times where you do rest your stars. And interestingly, Spurs are in a similar situation to Arsenal in that we're not good enough. The level of players and our player pool is not big enough in order for us to be able to do that and still be effective, I think.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I think the point on Arsenal in terms of the sort of fitness versus the defensive stability is that when they were really in that groove, they didn't look like conceding a goal. But I think now it's come to the kind of crunch point. That's now why they're being exposed that a little bit more defensively, because I think it is down to legs more than anything. I think that was evident a little bit against Villa, and I think also teams like Villa have sort of figured out the way that Arsenal want to play. But they do look incredibly solid defensively, and I think that transition to City and Arsenal mainly in terms of what a lot of teams have tried to do, or certainly a lot of top teams have tried to do, is shift to that sort of back four of essentially centre backs. And people will argue, like, kind of going back to what we were saying at the start, looking at it kind of more stoically in terms of like, is that the sort of football that you'd want your team to play? But then the trade off is that it's more effective in terms of getting results. And Arsenal might not win anything this year, but it's certainly been more effective in making them more solid than they were over the last sort of couple of years. And I think I've had questions and kind of conversations around should Spurs look at something similar? Like, should Spurs look at either signing someone who is capable of playing as that right back in a more traditional sense, but also then tucking in to sort of make that back three, allowing potentially a Doggy to be the only inverted fullback and go into midfield and play with Bissouma and those kind of things? I think we already have a player in our squad that is capable of doing that in Romero. I think Romero would be incredible as that sort of right back who could, he's so comfortable picking up the ball in central positions, but also out wide. I think he's got the defensive intelligence to do it. He's got the defensive ability to do it.
Yeah.
I think he'd be excellent at it. But then it's like you're taking away your best centre back to make that happen.
I don't think that's and like what do we know? But that I don't think that feels like a problem to me. In that, if you're sacrificing what we know is our best two centre backs by putting Romero as effectively a right back who can play, but is very much defensive minded, who can get forward, and then you say Odoghi is our inverted fullback, and then you have a back line when he goes forward of Dragosin, Romero and Van de Ven. So but what the point is that would require a shift in the system, and we haven't seen that as evident from Postecoglou yet. I do want to move on to how good our defence is, and this isn't me saying look how great our defenders are, these are amazing. I'm saying, do you think Van de Ven's meteoric rise in terms of his reputation this season has benefited actually from Postecoglou's system, because he's been given that opportunity to show his speed, make last ditch challenges that you often mostly completes, though he didn't against Newcastle, and there was one instance against West Ham where he couldn't manage it either. But while the system can be leaky, it does bring out the very best in our defenders, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely. I think there's always an interesting conversation around Van de Ven and Romero, because I was at the game, so I didn't see it, but from what I heard, Rio Ferdinand was giving Van de Ven the biggest praise before the game, saying arguably he's been one of the best, if not the best centre-backs in the Premier League this season, and compared him to a Rolls-Royce, and then completely put the mockers on him sort of for that performance. But it's interesting that on Van de Ven, in terms of the system, yes, definitely. I think he is a massive beneficiary of the way that Ange Postecoglou wants to play, but that doesn't detract anything from how good of a defender he is. And I actually think in certain games, his kind of reading of the game and being that sort of more front-footed defender and being at the back of centre-backs and being able to get right behind them and put them under pressure has actually gone under the radar. And that's something that Romero does so well every single game and makes us a brilliant counter-pressing side and makes us able to turn teams over in the middle of the pitch and often create chances from him getting high up the pitch onto the halfway line. But when Romero... I don't think Romero ever gets the same level of praise as Van de Ven, because what Van de Ven does stands out a hell of a lot more aesthetically in terms of, you think of those incredible recovery runs and those big crunching tackles, and obviously the goal that he scored against Nottingham Forest that was only part of that conversation obviously recently, but I think it's been going on for a lot longer than that, because Van de Ven is just a monster. He's such a unique defender, which kind of in a funny way makes it harder to judge how good he really is. And that's not me saying I don't think he's good at all, but he kind of truly is one of a kind, and I think he's incredible. But sometimes when you do, I'm not saying he relies on his physicality or his pace, but sometimes that will get you into trouble a little bit, and sometimes it can look a little bit awkward. Like you said, you're right to kind of bring up the West Ham game, and obviously he had that sort of unfortunate stumble with Antonio. And sometimes when you're that tall and that kind of that big almost, it's like it must be hard to kind of keep that balance a lot of the time, and obviously we saw that against Newcastle. But when you're put into these pressurised moments where you're the only defender there pretty much, those things can happen, and they're just things that unfortunately just go against you. So, and then you'll have the whole narrative will all of a sudden shift from how an incredible centre back he is to maybe overrated he is. He almost becomes memed overnight, and that's just football Twitter. That's what happens. I knew as soon as I opened up my phone at St. James's Park at halftime, every photo I was going to see was Van de Ven on his head with Isak going past him. But that doesn't take away from how incredible that he has been. And, you know, our record with and without Van de Ven is kind of night and day. I think he started either 21 or 22 Premier League games now. And I think the only two that we've lost in which he's played the full 90 minutes were Newcastle and the Wolves home game. And in that game, we didn't have either of our fullbacks, which again kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about the importance of the system. Obviously, in the Chelsea game, him and Romero both didn't complete 90 minutes for different reasons. But, you know, we are, when those two are in the team, they are two brilliant, brilliant centre-backs, and they complement each other so, so well. But I do think part of the fact that when you're judging them as individual defenders, they are brilliant, they are incredible. But I do think sometimes they might be struggling due to, I think it's more down to them being exposed due to other areas of the team not functioning as well as they have been. And you've seen how many chances.
I was going to ask that just to pick you up on that. Is that we're like, so like we know they're excellent, right? We know Pedro Porro and Adoghi are excellent. I know Adoghi isn't the, he's not the finished article yet. He needs to improve in certain areas. He can be lackadaisical sometimes in his passing, and he's conceded, he's been responsible for big errors and conceding big chances multiple times this season.
Both the fullbacks were kind of both responsible for the goals that put Van de Ven under that pressure, and it was Adoghi maybe not being strong enough on the sort of the halfway line with Gordon, and then Porro plays that ridiculously blind pass to put those under pressure. So yeah, you're right. Yeah,
yeah. So it's like, so there is opportunity for these players to improve, but the back line really isn't the issue, is it? The issue is what's happening during these games to concede the chances that we do concede. Like what? How can we eradicate that? What do you think needs to be done in order to ensure that we don't concede the chances? It can't be, this is just the way we play and we are going to concede chances, because that in the long run isn't going to play out. And there's no way Postecoglou's going, don't worry, we'll just give up these chances, it's not a problem. Because there's an interesting statistic in that before the Newcastle game, we faced the third least amount of shots to our goal so far this season. But it didn't show how many key chances we've conceded, and that discrepancy is probably huge. Like by retaining possession, you're preventing the opportunity for your opponent to get the ball in the box or shoot on goal. But when they do get the opportunity, it's such a big chance that it almost doesn't matter. That the first statistic is redundant, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. The kind of higher volume of high XG chances would be off the scale compared to the other teams that have conceded that least. I think it was Arsenal and Man City, wasn't it?
Who were
below us. I think that's kind of evident in the goals that we have actually been conceding, where there have been goals where teams have basically essentially found it impossible to miss, or an incredibly good chance of scoring that we've given up because of the deficiencies in certain aspects of, not necessarily the way we play, but that system. But I think it comes back to personnel. I think you can, not to single put individual players out, but I think there have been a number of goals recently that we've conceded on the transition that highlights the fact that I think that is a position in terms of that number six that we should look to potentially upgrade if you do really want to kick on. Somebody who can cover that ground, somebody who's got the tactical discipline and awareness of where the space that he needs to cover is. And I think Bissouma, I think, has been too lax in that often in recent weeks. Not necessarily in the Newcastle game, because I think, again, Newcastle's press completely nullified anything that he was able to do on the ball, and then he was under immense pressure when we gave the ball away higher up the pitch, and he can't do it all on his own. But in certain home games recently, especially against the quote-unquote lesser sides in the division, you do feel as if that kind of discipline is lacking a little bit. I think there have been too many goals that we've conceded that you can put down to him. And I think if Spurs are going to kick on, but you want to kind of, Ange wants to stick to those principles. And again, we talked about it earlier, principles don't necessarily always correlate to the fact that the system is going to stay the same. But I think that's an obvious area for sort of upgrading. Someone who just will cover that ground and eat it up. Someone like a Rice, someone like a Rodri, obviously, but those of, you know, just in terms of profile, but someone who can do that and leave our centre backs less vulnerable. But then it maybe also requires we're going into a run of games now where the spotlight will probably be on that more than any other, because we've got a North London derby, we've got a Chelsea game, we've got a Liverpool game, all games where you could see us suffering in parts of it because of how the quality of the opposition. So in terms of the immediate future, do you then go to more of a sort of a double pivot in midfield to give that defence that little bit more protection? Do you play Bentancourt in there instead of Bissouma? Do you play Højbjerg in there? Someone who, I think, against Forest when he came on, you could see that he was far more willing to sort of track those runners on the transition than maybe Bissouma was. There was a couple of examples of him side by side with Bissouma where he was doing exactly what Bissouma should have been doing as that number six. So I think that's an obvious area that needs upgrading. Obviously, set pieces have become a big issue and a big problem for Spurs as well. And again, you're kind of going into that run of games against Arsenal, who score a lot of goals from corners and free kicks.
The Newcastle game is ridiculous how we were just unable to clear.
It was unbelievable, yeah.
It was unreal. It was shockingly bad. And you can't concede chances like that from corners consistently over a game without being punished.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And yeah, I think there was like something. Sorry, I was going to say, I think they had something like 13 corners. And from my memory, they won the first header on every single corner.
Yeah, that feels right.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous.
So we're looking at a. If Bissouma and Bentancur can't play in the six in Ange's system, then we're going to need to upgrade that significantly to someone who can. And having a centre forward who, you know, as we discussed on the show, we talked about potential number nines coming into Tottenham. If you want to listen to that, go back and listen to it. Me and Ben discuss potential number nines who could be signing for Spurs this season, realistically speaking. Yeah. And all of them have the attributes to receive the ball with a back to goal. And Heung-min Son has been criticised relatively unfairly, I think. Unfairly in my eyes,
yeah,
but this in the last month or so, because he's been asked to do something in the absence of Richarlison that he's never been comfortable with doing, which is receiving the ball with his back to goal. He's always struggled with that. In Conte's system, it was part of the reason why he was so absent last season, because he was doing so much of that work and he's not built for it. It's just not, not his style. And so, you know, he's been nullified and somewhat our tactics been nullified by the fact that we haven't been able to have that target man that you can play the ball into. And you absolutely know that 9 times out of 10, he's giving it back to someone. He's laying it off. We're to be able to build attacks around that centre forward, where we can't at the moment. Richarlison, you remember Richarlison's goal scoring streak, but a massive part of his play was how he was bringing others into the game. I remember against Manchester United, he was. I thought he was our. If I'm remembering the game correctly, he was.
He was excellent.
Yeah, and a massive part of that was when we got the ball. Even if he was under pressure, he was laying it off. And, you know, Son isn't good at that. He's not good at that. But he's amazing at so many other things. And him being able to play off a player like that would be exceptional. But we're not at that stage. We haven't been able to do it. And no doubt we are addressing it in the summer. That all of those things lead to a more secure team. Because the biggest time we've been exposed, the amount of times we've been exposed, is losing the ball in silly positions or not having the personnel that make us most effective. And if you do have those, then those errors will inevitably be cut out because they'll be able to find the right people in the right spaces. That's my hope. That's what I hope Postecoglou is working on. I'm sure he's acutely aware of all of these issues, and no doubt it's going to be a stressful month for all Spurs fans, but it could also be an amazing month, Ben. It could be. Is there anything else you wanted to add about our defensive system before we wrap up?
I think it's just like you kind of said at the end there. It's when you play that kind of high risk, high reward football, the onus then for me becomes a lot more on the individual quality. And I think that was evident against Newcastle, because if you want to play that way, that's fine, but you have to have the players to be able to look after the ball like you said. And I think the Newcastle game was completely evident of that. There have been games where we've maybe, you know, the Newcastle game is kind of the only game recently where we've sort of massively come under fire like that. We've given away silly goals in certain games, but the narrative coming out of some of the games recently hasn't always, the main focus of it has been we aren't able to break down the low blocks. But there are players that kind of goes hand in hand a little bit with the defensive instability, in just in terms of having that striker that can look after the ball and bring other players into play, because it stops you being that vulnerable in transition because you've got someone looking after the ball. But then it also allows you to have that sort of focal point in the box when you are struggling to break down low blocks. I think that is kind of the key. And I think, yeah, when you've got that high risk, high reward football, it's so much about the individual. But like you said, this could be, a lot of Spurs fans are bricking it going into these few games, but I think there's reasons to be optimistic, and I think there's a lot to learn from the Newcastle game for sure.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. And if people want to catch more of Ben, you can listen to his podcast. How did he find it? What's it called, and how do they find it, Ben?
Thank you, mate. So yeah, it's the Daring and Doing podcast. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, and YouTube as well. YouTube, you can find sort of more short form, 10-minute sort of bites as well. If you don't want to listen to me and Will, who I do the podcast with, chat for an hour and a half, you can kind of assume the key talking points of what we're talking about there. So yeah, mate, nice one. I appreciate that.
No worries. Thank you for coming on once again, Ben. This has been the Lab Podcast. Mate, if you're still with us, please, please give us five star ratings on Spotify. Leave reviews, all helpful, and set your podcast to automatic downloads. That's really helpful as well. I mean, it's there for you whenever you need it, whenever you open your app. Okay, we'll be back soon with more. And by the way, if you've listened to this but haven't listened to other episodes of The Lab, most of it's evergreen. As discussed in the middle of this podcast, did an amazing episode with a guy called Gareth Dace, who's written a book about the decade of the 90s and what an interesting time it was for Tottenham. It's a fascinated chat. Me and Ben have talked about a number nine options as discussed. I also did an interview with Jeff Shreves about the art of touchline reporting, and I'm sure you know who Jeff Shreves is, but if you don't, he has he was a touchline reporter since the start of the Premier League football up until a couple of seasons ago. All interesting stuff, so there for you to enjoy. Up the Spurs, and we'll see you soon.
Up the Spurs.
Sports Social Podcast Network.